Good evening, and welcome behind the news for March 31st, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking most weeks, as we do at this time, at the worlds of economics and of politics. I've got two interviews up for tonight. First, in about 6 or 7 minutes, interview recorded earlier this week with Camilo Mejia, who deserted from his U.S. unit in Iraq and just got out after spending a year in a military prison. And we'll talk to him about his prison experience, his conversion into an anti-war activist, his critique of the established order, and what he's doing to address these issues. And then at the bottom of the hour, a little change of pace for this program, I'll be speaking with two novelists, Nicola Krause and Emma McLaughlin, who are the authors of the smash hit Nanny Diaries, sold over 2 million copies, and more recently of Citizen Girl, which is about the workplace, the world of work that someone just a couple of years out of college faces. But we'll talk to them about how you write very stylish and entertaining novels about very serious topics, among other things. But before we get to all this, a couple of news headlines to look at. The usual economic news headlines today, this morning, the U.S. Department of Labor announced that, well, gosh, no wonder these headphones aren't working. They're not plugged in. So let me dispose of those and continue. The U.S. Department of Labor announced that their tally of weekly claims for first-time applications for unemployment insurance, a very timely and sensitive indicator of the state of the job market, that was up 20,000, a very surprisingly large amount last week. The four-week moving average, which just averages the trailing 4 weeks as a way to smooth out the week-to-week volatility in this series, also rose to 336,000. So after taking a very sharp dip late last year, early this, it's now been rising for a couple of months now. So this this could be a sign that the improvement in the job market we saw last year may be running out of steam. So we shall see. We'll get a clue about that tomorrow morning when the monthly employment report is released. We'll get the full tally of jobs created and the unemployment rate and all those related materials. My guess is we'll see a gain of about 200, 250,000 jobs, which may sound like a lot, but really is just about average for the performance of the U.S. economy. We've seen much, much less than that, and so low are expectations now that to some ears, that 250,000 sounds like a big number, but it really isn't. It's just about average, but we're struggling to achieve mediocrity in the U.S. job market these days. This morning was also reported by the Census Bureau, or rather the Bureau of Economic Analysis, that personal income in the month of February was up by just 0.3%, which is somewhat below what most economists were projecting. Wage growth, just 0.2%. And we know that in the month of February, the average hourly earnings for most U.S. workers was unchanged. So a slack job market and weak wage growth. And this is not a very good thing if we want to keep this expansion going. Although people, that didn't stop people from buying. Consumption, personal spending rose 0.5%, which was considerably ahead of what income was doing. That meant the savings rate fell to, it's pretty close to zero now. So Americans not saving, they seem to be borrowing and spending everything they've got, which is really not a healthy thing to do in the long run, but that seems to be the American way. The Mortgage Bankers Association reporting yesterday that their index of applications for new mortgages rose on the week, but that was almost entirely the result of an increase of house purchases. Their tally of so-called refinancings, people who refinance their mortgage and very often take cash out of the deal when they do and spend that cash, a very important source of spending growth in the economy over the last couple of years. That is fading. So it does look like we're losing that stimulus from free refinancing. At the same time, the job market is sort of not doing so great, and wage growth is certainly not doing great at all. So we're going to need something to substitute for our earning and borrowing if we're going to keep consumption going. So it's going to be an interesting crossroads for the U.S. economy. And with oil prices, they were off yesterday, but back up today. Oil prices quite high and seeming to take a bite out of personal incomes. Consumer confidence, both the Conference Board's monthly measure in March and the ABC Washington Post weekly measure last week, falling, and much more than anyone expected. The ABC Washington Post index is at a 9-month low. And it does also seem, if you look at the political polls, George Bush's approval ratings of the economy are slipping to very low numbers. I think the Gallup latest CBS poll has him at a 36% approval rating on the economy. The Social Security stuff is certainly not helping. Public seems to be turning against that. But also people just don't think this is a great economy. It's not a great time to find a job. And we can say similar things about Mexico, with the unemployment rate creeping higher in our southern neighbor to 3.9%. That's kind of a ridiculous number because it excludes people who are not in the so-called formal economy. People who are selling pencils on the street are not counted as unemployed or employed or anything. They just don't exist as far as the statisticians go. But the level is ridiculous. The direction does give us some sense of what's going on, and that does seem to be some deterioration in Mexican job market. So maybe some of the weakness here is spreading down south. So let's take a little musical break, and I'll be back to introduce Camilo Mejia. And that little excerpt from Let Them Eat War by Bad Religion from the Rock Against Bush Volume 2 collection from Fat Wreck Records. A very fine collection if you like that sort of thing. So if you want to rock against Bush, pick up Volumes 1 and or 2. And that, by way of introduction to this interview recorded earlier this week with Camilo Mejia, who was in town and stopped by my office. So I sat him down and recorded this interview. Camilo deserted from his unit in Iraq, was underground for a little while, then surrendered and served a year in a military prison and just got out about a month ago. So here's Camilo Mejia describing his experience in prison and his political evolution and what his plans are. When did you get out of prison?
Just a little bit over a month ago, actually, on February 15th of this year.
And what was it like?
Prison wasn't really a very bad experience. It was hard being away from my family, but the conditions within the prison were quite comfortable. And I did get to meet a lot of wonderful people, made some new friends, and got to spend some time away, you know, from the crazy world outside, and got to do some reading and writing. It wasn't a very bad experience also because I received a lot of support from all over the world and from all over the United States. I got close to 10,000 letters while I was there. I wasn't allowed to read most of them, but just to know that so many people care and that so many people supported my stance made it very easy for me to not feel lonely, even behind bars.
Who else was in the prison? What kind of people?
Well, the criteria was 10 years or less, but the crimes actually it could be anything from AWOL or desertion all the way to murder and, you know, theft and rape and things like that. So it wasn't really by crime, but by time.
And did either the fellow prisoners or the staff treat you as a traitor or anything reprehensible like that?
No, actually, no. They have a policy, I guess, to not judge the inmates, and they're very careful about that. There's a lot of ignorance within the guards, and sometimes you feel that, you know, there's a little bit of disagreement there, but they're very careful in not mentioning anything, and I was very respected as far as my political views and the reason why I was there.
As far as you can tell, what's the feeling among the fellow troops? Is there spreading discontent in the ranks, or are people just going along and doing what they have to do?
Well, from my limited point of view, because I just got out of prison and we weren't really very informed in jail, but from what little I know, at the time I actually surrendered back to military control, there were about 500 AWOL troops reported by the Pentagon. Now that number is between 5,500 and 6,000 troops that are considered AWOL or deserters. And that's a pretty significant increase, you know, in a year. So that's one measure. And another measure is, you know, being incarcerated with 120 other inmates who feel like they have nothing to lose. So when you look at the military and when you look at people within the military, as far as them giving their views or speaking publicly or speaking openly about their feelings, they usually don't, because there's a lot of fear that they will be incarcerated, they will be punished. But when you deal with people in prison, it's different because they've already been through the process, so they're more open about it. And I can tell you that the majority of the people in the jail where I was incarcerated were against the war, either on political grounds or moral grounds, or simply didn't want to fight the war because they didn't believe in it. They think that the White House and the government pretty much lied and that we're there just for oil, and they simply wouldn't support the war or, you know, put themselves in harm's way, you know, to fight for some rich group of people to get richer.
It also seems now that they're having recruiting troubles. So is this whole volunteer army model in trouble if they're going to deploy people to pointless war?
I think that's also a measure of discontent within the ranks, that they're upping their effort to recruit people. I know that they're even investing money in video games, that once the young person is done playing the video game, you know, it sends them directly to a recruiting website, and they're throwing parties, actually inviting young men and women, 17 and older, to go to these parties and play with the video games. And, you know, they invite them and tell them, you can play with real soldiers and real weapons. And, you know, that's how they're getting people. They're also upping the effort as far as bonuses and as far as, you know, making it more appealing for people from active duty to go into reserve units. But they're finding it very hard, because being in an active duty unit and being in a reserve unit are pretty much the same thing. A lot of the pull from the National Guard and reserves came from prior military service, because they figured, you know, we'll do our service to our country, you know, 1 week in a month, and if there's a natural disaster, you know, we go and help out the people in our hometown. But now there's really no difference. You know, a person who's in the National Guard or the reserve can end up in combat for as much as 18 months or 24 months, as much as a regular army soldier. So a lot of people are having second thoughts about that, and the recruiting numbers are dropping below the expectation, you know, what is acceptable by the military. So they're upping their effort, you know, and using many different avenues to recruit more people.
Have you been in touch with any of your former comrades in your unit?
Only a couple of them. I really haven't had a whole lot of time to come in contact with many of them. It's one thing I have to do, but it's been really crazy since I got out, you know, spending time with my family and trying to deal with the media and trying to deal with, you know, going to places and lending my voice to the movement for peace and justice. I've been traveling a lot, so I haven't really had a whole lot of peace of mind and time to sit down and start making important phone calls to people that I really care about.
Are they still in Iraq, most of them?
No, most of them came right around the time that I was sent back to military control. So they've been here. I know that some of them are going back to the Middle East, I believe to Afghanistan, but it's not going to be a very large unit, maybe platoon or company level. But I really haven't talked to a whole lot of them. And my priority would be to contact the members of my squad. You know, I've only spoken with maybe one of them.
I believe the Abu Ghraib news was revealed after you went to prison?
No, actually, the Abu Ghraib scandal happened right around my court-martial date, perhaps maybe a couple of weeks before. And what's interesting to point out is that they had said that, you know, this wasn't systematic and that this wasn't a matter of you know, the higher leadership, but it was just a few bad apples, you know, that did something bad, you know, an isolated event, when in reality, you know, I had turned in an application for conscientious objection as early as March 16th of 2003, where I related, you know, some of the issues that later came out, you know, in the prison abuse scandal. And these were issues that were taking place, you know, these were problems that were happening, you know, dealing with prisoner mistreatment as early as April of 2003 and coming from very high up, so.
What kinds of things did you see, or what are you talking about?
I'm talking about sleep deprivation, and I'm talking about, you know, the criteria for capturing people and labeling them enemy combatants, and, you know, the practice of hooding people and the practice of, you know, using psychological methods to keep people awake, you know, like, for instance, banging sledgehammers against walls to keep them awake and make them feel like there's an explosion, or performing mock executions with pistols, you know, next to their heads to make them think that they're about to be executed in order to keep them awake for long periods of time so that they could speak and tell the interrogators whatever they need to hear.
How was this communicated? Were you... Where did the orders come specifically to do specified things, or were it just sort of vague orders that you're supposed to figure out yourself what to do?
It was sort of a crash course. We went in there, and this was a very improvised POW camp. And the soldiers who were there pretty much told us, okay, these are the combatants, these are the non-combatants, these are the guys who interrogate them. They'll tell you who to keep up and for how long, and this is how you do it. And it's a guy banging a wall with a sledgehammer. And then they tell you, and if that doesn't work, then the guy grabs a gun and cocks it next to the guy's ear and tells you this will do the trick or whatever. So it was all very informal. It was all very unofficial. No high-ranking official came and told you have to do this or you have to do that. It's more subtle than that. But it's happening, and, you know, it's a widespread practice, and it's systematic, and it's from the very beginning.
How did your experience in prison change you? You said you did a lot of reading and thinking. What happened?
Well, it changed me in many ways. I don't think that it would be possible for me right now to give a clear explanation of how is it that it changed me. But I can tell you that I came out a lot more humble from prison, because I went from being a very comfortable person before going to war. You know, I was a college student, you know, doing research in psychology and just living a very comfortable life. And then I went to being an infantry squad leader in a war zone, to being a prisoner, you know, who has to start from the bottom and who has to live with people from, you know, all kinds of backgrounds, all kinds of different ideas. And, you know, went from being a squad leader in war to being a dishwasher and then working with sewing machines and things like that. So, you know, you have to earn your way all over again, and you have to learn to tolerate and accept people, you know, for who they are. You have to live with 14 other inmates, you know, 7/24 for almost 9 months. That was one thing. And then the other thing was that because of my views and because of my moral principles, I ended up being in prison. But there wasn't really a sense that I had lost my freedom, because I had exercised enough freedom to do what I believed was the right thing. So being in prison, if anything, empowered me as far as my own personal freedom in doing what I felt was the right thing to do, and, you know, receiving all the help from people, the support from people, also made me realize that I wasn't alone, you know, that there are many people throughout the world who feel the same way I do. There are many people here in America who feel the same way that I do. And I felt very connected. But it would be really hard to actually tell you right now, this is how it changed, or this is what I've learned. It's such a big lesson that I think that I might even die one day not realizing, you know, the extent to which this experience transformed me.
I'm speaking with Camila Mejia, who was released just last month after serving a year in a military prison for deserting his unit in Iraq. I was surprised in just reading the covers in the New York Times and some other media that it was more sympathetic than I would have guessed. They didn't really demonize you. Have you found, what kind of treatment have you, now that you're out, what kind of treatment have you gotten from people?
It hasn't really been bad. I have a website right now, and a lot of the people who write to the website, I'd say about 99% of them are very positive. You have a couple of them, you know, who yell out coward or traitor and things like that. But for the most part, it's been really positive, I think.
Well, there's nothing cowardly about what you did. That was very brave.
Well, that depends on who's looking at it. I don't think it's cowardly. I think it was more cowardly to have gone to the war disagreeing with it because I was afraid of jail and being court-martialed. But some people find it cowardly because, you know, you're in war and then you leave and you don't want to return and be a part of it in terms of, you know, removing yourself from a firefight or removing yourself from a war zone, they find that to be cowardly. I don't think it's cowardly. I don't think I'm a hero either. You know, a lot of people call me hero. You know, I think I'm somewhere in between being a hero and being a coward. But the response has been very positive. I think that, you know, all this support, this alleged support for the war, it's more of a media fabrication than reality. I think a lot of people are getting tired of this war. At a personal level, I'm feeling that. You know, I'm feeling a lot of support and I'm feeling a lot of sympathy from people.
Well, you are to some, you know, even if you're not a hero, you're to some degree a model for people. Do you find that people like GIs coming up to you and asking, how'd you do it, or well, what should I do, or do you, people ask you for advice?
Not a whole lot of GIs, but people within the war and peace movement, I mean the justice and peace movement, have come up to me and told me how my story has inspired them. And I don't see that as a personal story, but I see it, I guess it's a personal story, but it's more than that, because it's a story about someone who isn't necessarily a soldier, but just simply someone, a human being, who decided to follow his conscience. And this is something that can be in any area. You know, you don't have to be at war. You know, you could be a doctor, you could be a nurse, you could be a cab driver, and just simply following your conscience and expressing your views, it's really important. You know, that's what makes, you know, the difference. You know, soldiers are not going to vote against a Republican Party or a pro-war party. Regular people are going to do that. So if my story has served to inspire people to do what their heart tells them to do, I think that we're going to be in much better shape morally as a nation and in the world as well. You know, as the only world superpower, I think we have a huge responsibility to the world. And if I have helped people realize that it's really important to express your opinions and speak your mind, even at some personal cost, then I'm very happy with that.
What kind of things do people respond to? And when you're telling a story or you know, agitating against the war, are there certain themes that sort of ordinary audiences, maybe who might not be part of the peace movement, would respond to?
Well, you know, the my experience is very diverse, I guess, because I'm an immigrant and because I'm not a U.S. citizen and because I'm Hispanic and because I went to college and because I was 9 years in the military, because I was a staff sergeant, because I was an infantryman, because I was in war, because I was a fugitive for a while and then went through a court-martial and then went through a CO hearing or a conscientious objector hearing. So there are many different things that people will really want to talk about. I have some people, I'm a Catholic too, so that's also another thing. Some people want me to speak about my experience from a Catholic point of view as a conscientious objector. Some people want me to speak about the legal aspect of my court-martial and the CO hearing. Some people want to talk about my overall transformation from being an infantryman to being a conscientious objector and being incarcerated because of my public denouncement of the war. So it all depends, you know. There's not one particular theme that people want to ask you about, you know, but there's a number of things, and, you know, I'm more than happy to talk about anything people want me to talk about. You know, I'm here to share my experience. I think it's important. I think it's my duty to share my experience.
What turned you against the war? I mean, you were in the military for quite a few years, so was it just a gradual progression of events, or are there dramatic moments that made you, you know, see things very differently? How did it happen?
Well, to begin with, I have opposed the war from the very beginning, even before the war started, but it was a very political opposition because I didn't think that the government had made a case for war as far as weapons of mass destruction and things like that. To me, it was a huge lie. So I disagreed with the war politically from the very beginning. The transformation that took place as a result of going to Iraq was a more spiritual and personal transformation, which is the transformation that many soldiers go through after they experience war. And it's not a transformation that took place in a day or two, but it was more of a process of realization. And it was a very painful process because there are so many things involved in making a decision to separate yourself from war and to separate yourself from your unit. Your family included, you know, your comrades included, the people in your squad included. And there's no particular incident, you know, there's no particular horrific vision, you know, that does it. At least not for me. I'm sure people have different experiences. But for me, it was more of an overall thing, beginning with my political opposition against the war, going through the dynamics of combat and being in a place where to survive you have to kill people. And, you know, being in a place where more could be done in order to preserve life, you know, the lives of soldiers and the lives of innocent civilians. And you just come to a realization that it's not really one particular war that you're against, but it's every war, you know, because every war, in my opinion, is paid for with the blood of the innocent. So it's really hard to pinpoint a moment or a particular experience that triggered the transformation. It's more of a process.
I imagine that when you're in combat with a group of people, you develop very intense personal bonds with each other. So was it difficult? Did you see that in some way you're abandoning or betraying your comrades, even if you didn't like the war itself?
Absolutely. I mean, it was one of the most, if not the most difficult decision I've ever made in my life. Because when your life depends on other people, you know, when your life is in the hands of other people and you depend on one another for survival, it's really hard to separate yourself from that. But you have to actually look at the bigger picture. You have to look at the bigger picture as far as, do we have a right to be there? And if we don't, are we justified in any of the things that we're doing here? Is a single life worth what we're doing here? You know, and when I ask myself, what are we doing here? And I find everything to point out at oil and corporate profit, it's really hard to actually say, okay, I'm going to go back because I love this man. I'm going to go back because I'm an infantryman or because I'm a squad leader. But that doesn't take away the pain of leaving your comrades, you know, because even though you're not justified in being there, they're there, you know, and you're so close to them that it's really painful and really difficult. But I don't really regret it. It's a painful decision. Sometimes we have to make decisions which, you know, either way you go, it's going to be painful and it's going to hurt you. But, you know, you just have to use your judgment and make, you know, what your heart tells you to do.
An important part of organizing against the Vietnam War was a lot of the work around organizing GIs, the GI coffee house movement and such. Is there any potential for that sort of thing now, do you think?
I think there's a lot of resistance still amongst the mainstream public. A lot of people, even who oppose the war, are still resisting the idea of a completely pacifist movement. You know, I think there's a lot of division in the movement to stop the war and for peace. You have some soldiers even who disagree with this particular war, but don't disagree with militarism and don't disagree particularly with U.S. foreign policy. And when you really become informed in terms of what this war means in terms of history, you realize that it's not an isolated event but a trend. And to actually stop that, it's not enough to just stop the war, but to actually change from a very deep point, you have to change the entire approach the U.S. has towards the world. And a lot of people are failing to see that. A lot of people are failing to make really important connections. For instance, I was very happy when I went to Detroit and there was an anti-war rally, and they were making the connection between the war and the loss of jobs at home and social injustice in general. And I think it's very important for people to do that, but people are not doing that. So I don't really see a movement. I see a big movement, and I see that you know, we're going in the right direction, but I think that there's a lot more to be done. I don't think we're quite at the Vietnam level yet.
So what are you doing now, and what are your plans? How are you going to agitate against the war?
Well, you know, I've been 25 months, actually close to 26 months away from my daughter, who's 4.5 years old. So a huge priority is to spend time with her. At the same time, of course, I want to lend my voice to the movement, and I want to attend rallies, and I want to attend events, give interviews, and just do as much as I can to contribute to the movement to stop the war and to spread conscience, really, because it's not all just about a war, you know. I mean, there are so many issues out there. You know, the war, I think it's a trigger, you know, to unleash a number of other issues that need to be addressed and that need to be looked at by the people, you know, like, for instance, starvation and poverty and, you know, the global war on terrorism and all these other things that, you know, largely get neglected, you know, until something big happens that gets people's attention into this particular issue, which the larger issue, I guess, is the injustice and corporate greed. It's a much, much larger issue than just war. You know, it's much bigger than that.
That was Camilo Mejia, who deserted from his unit in Iraq and spent a year in a military prison, just got out last month, and he's now making his way around the country talking about his experiences and agitating against the war. Let's take a little break, and we'll be back with Emma McLaughlin and Nicola Krause.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over, and there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
And as the man said, this is WBAI. This is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we'll be back in a moment. But let's just take another musical break. This with Sonic Youth.
Try to recover myself, but in this moment I am lost. It's always blood, fear, politics, and money. I don't know how to stop vomiting since I've been working in August.
And that little excerpt from The Ineffable Me by Sonic Youth, who are not terribly youthful when they recorded that, but neither am I, so what's so much for that. It's always blood, fear, politics, and money, I think is what she said. And now we're joined by two novelists, a little change of pace for this show, Emma McLaughlin and Nicola Krause, who are had a book that came out a couple of years ago called The Nanny Diaries, a big-time bestseller, and then a book that came out more recently, late last year, called Citizen Girl, and rather different from The Nanny Diaries. But let me start by asking, you've written both these novels together. What's it like to collaborate on writing a novel? What's what's your process?
Well, this is Nikki. I've only ever collaborated, so we don't really know what the other side of it. We hear it's very lonely. So for us, I think it's a tremendous blessing having the advantage of two sets of eyes, two brains. I feel like we do everything twice as fast, and it's twice as efficient having two of us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the husband of a friend of mine is a screenwriter who has worked in collaboration with a writing partner, and the way I hear it, it's almost like a marriage. There's a lot of emotional turmoil. Fights, reconciliations.
It's probably
like
you bring
you?
Each other flowers.
Yes, which we actually do. I think it is like a marriage, whatever that means to you. Luckily for us, I think that what it means for us is we're communicating 24/7, and we've had to learn an enormous amount about relating, about sort of co-parenting, if you will, really having an entire business just between the two of us. And, you know, starting off in our mid-20s, we've been young babes in the woods figuring that out. But luckily for us, I think the definition of marriage is there's an extremely healthy and probably just extreme level of communication. So we're talking constantly.
So how did you strike up this collaboration? Just one day it struck you, let's write this novel or what?
Well, we met in college 10 years ago, and 5 years ago, the economy was spiking, and suddenly childcare was very much in the media, and the people doing the childcare were never interviewed in the articles we read. And I think that got us talking about the fact that someone should really put something out there. And eventually we were like, well, why don't we put something out there? And Emma was working in organizational development. I was acting at the time. So we had other jobs. We didn't think we were going to be writing professionally, but we'd always been very interested in storytelling. And so that was really the impetus to start collaborating. And once we started collaborating, I think we realized that amazingly we have a similar voice, we have the identical sense of humor and values. And so once we discovered there was something there, we've been writing together now for 5 years.
You have the style is very stylish. you turn good phrases and make good jokes. Those both sort of come out of you together. There's no division of labor.
Of style?
Yeah.
And funny? No.
She's funny.
She's stylish. No, it really is a 50-50. There was a wonderful interview with Tina Fey, I think in Bust magazine a long time ago when her film Mean Girls came out, and she talked about the dark level of dark humor that would go on behind doors at Saturday Night Live and the level of darkness and humor that humorists and satirists kind of spend their behind the scenes time
and indulge in.
And we certainly
Saturday Night Live could do a little bit more of that on the screen rather than behind the doors.
Well, so we giggle through our day. We do tend to find the absurd in most of how we spend our time.
We go on long riffs and long tangents, a lot of what ifs. You know, what if this word came off the page and started to protest because we cut it and developed a little union and walked off and refused to ever be used by us again? And how would we write a whole book without before?
Well, that would be a challenge. I had a roommate in college who took a poetry writing course, and Richard Howard had him write a poem one week using only the left-hand keys of the typewriter, and the next week only the right-hand keys of the typewriter. So you can
Who wrote
limit
that
your...
book without the letter E?
Oh, I don't know. That would be a tough one to write, wouldn't it?
I can't remember the title of it, but it's a whole book without the letter E. No the, no me.
No me. That would be really a challenge. So do you write every day? Is it like a job for you?
Oh, yeah, Monday through Friday. Absolutely. Uh-huh. And we're very committed, and we do take vacations. But otherwise, I think we have so many ideas, and if we didn't work 5 days a week, and sometimes we work 7 days a week, we wouldn't be able to execute, you know, all the things that we want to put out there. So we're very disciplined.
Now, the Nanny Diaries was, I think, a bit of a surprise hit. I mean, you got, according
well,
to
for us, it was a 100% surprise hit.
Well, yeah, well, from what I read from the size of the advance, that might have surprised the publisher, too.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
But had you both nannied?
Yes, we did. We both nannied in college to, you know, subsidize our education, and because we were both doing child development studies to supplement our education as well. And I think at the time we really were purely doing it with no ulterior motive in mind at all. It was absolutely just, you know, the best job that we could find while we were at NYU. But it was definitely an intense experience that I think really formed who we became as women.
Yeah, absolutely.
How?
I think it's a very strange role being in someone's home and having that be your workplace, especially if it's your first professional experience and you're trying to figure out what the boundaries are, because it's an entirely boundaryless environment. Also having the incredibly intense experience of really co-parenting.
Yeah, you're doing something that's at once very intimate, but in some way you're supposed to be invisible too.
Exactly. Right? And sort of walking that line, finding that dance, and making the parent, especially in a dysfunctional situation, feel good about abdicating their role. So you've replaced them. You're definitely judging them for doing it. And at the same time, you're trying to ingratiate yourself to someone you don't even respect. It's intense.
Yeah. I don't know how much fictional caricature is involved in the book, but the people, the parents in it don't come off as very nice human beings.
We say about the Nanny Diaries that it was the impression left upon us by a community. It really was.
Which is the very upper reaches of Upper East Side society.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The families we worked for certainly ran the gamut. We had wonderful families and wonderful employment situations. But that community definitely has social mores very much in place around child rearing that are bizarre to us.
Yeah.
In what way?
Time spent with your child's not really a value. And, you know, aesthetics and appearances seem to be valued higher.
Than intimacy, true intimacy, not just, you know, sexual intimacy, but relational intimacy. On the floor relationship that I think certainly we grew up with parents who hung out down on the floor with us, not for hours on end, but it just doesn't seem to be a high value as much as having the nanny, the nannies. Plural, having childcare with you constantly, being out and about, doing whatever it is that Mrs. X does, which Nanny can never quite put her finger on how she spends her time, but it is certainly not with her son.
Yeah, it seems that, well, Daddy spends his day remaking corporate America on Wall Street, and Mom does goes to lunch and maybe some charity work. Is this?
Yes, it's a mystery.
It's a mystery. But it does seem that once people get some money, they want to contract out the child rearing.
It seems that, I mean, definitely in the family that we invented, that is the case. That is their priority. And that's obviously not the case. I mean, the reason we created the character of the grandmother in the book, who is wealthy and kind-hearted, was to sort of be a foil for that. And H.H. lives in the same building line, and he was raised with lots of warmth and lots of intimacy. So we tried to show other families in that milieu who had better values. It just happens to be the choices the exes are making are the wrong ones.
That was the voice of Nicola Krause, who is here in the studio along with her novelist collaborator, Emma McLaughlin. Well, as these two novels are at once kind of light, entertaining fiction, but there's a lot of serious stuff behind the lightness. How do you handle this balance? I mean, you're talking, you know, in Nanny Dies, you're really talking about class, labor, family relations, you know, kinds of things that people write dissertations on, yet it was anything but a dissertation to read.
Yeah, absolutely. That was definitely the goal. I think that we, in our lives and in our friendship, we've always been really had our radar up for satire that is remarkably funny, that goes into really tough places, but really relieves you with the laughter of the absurdity of those places. And, you know, writers like David Sedaris, who actually, he has a short story called The Sandaland Diaries, which was the initial structural inspiration for Nanny Diaries. But we always reference many male writers. We don't know of many female writers who do this kind of humorous satire similarly.
Who use humor to look at social injustice. Because I think otherwise these situations are just unpalatable.
Yeah.
Especially the conundrum of the four-year-old. I mean, he's so powerless and so heartbroken by the end of the book that I think if we didn't infuse the story with as much humor as possible, I wouldn't want to read it.
And I also think that the satire is a tool for illuminating that, in our opinion, both the social explorations of Citizen Girl and the Nanny Diaries, there are social solutions within them that don't necessarily require a team from NASA to sit around a table and look at the whole spectrum of how, you know, the sciences and the atmospheres and read the tests and call in another team from the Uganda to do a reading on that. You know, these are choices that people are making. And in our
with obvious
right,
solutions.
You know,
well,
spend
one
give them a bath.
Right.
It's very simple.
The parents also have too much money.
But I think that this is not, it's in our mind, because both the situations we explore ultimately aren't rocket science, even though their age, you know, the state of culture in the Nanny Diaries, the state of the affluent and the upstairs-downstairs dynamics go back to antiquity. And with Citizen Girl, we're looking at sexual politics, that if walking into these worlds, right now the dynamics feel extremely so complex that where does one even begin to seek change or evolution? And I think we use humor as a way of trying to cut to the quick of, where is there clear absurdities that reveal that this is actually pretty simple? You know, a guy buying a woman. You know, these are choices. It is pretty black and white. It actually is not so complicated. So it's a tool that really suits us and fascinates us, and it's where our passion is in literature, definitely.
Although in some ways this almost seems like a satire-proof society. Our neighborhood, L'Occitane on the Upper West Side, had your Nanny Diaries book open to the page about the lavender water, which
really?
They were using on the lavender water display.
You're kidding.
And they didn't seem to think it was
bizarre.
There was no fun being poked anywhere.
That's
so
amazing.
It was just in a book. That's all I cared about. It's in a book. Buy it. The capacity
funny.
Of our society to absorb satire is remarkable. But you also, there's some emotional complexity in the Nanny Diaries in that there's great sympathy for the kid, even though he'll probably grow up to be a bourgeois monster like his parents. But right now, you know, you have sympathy for the kid, even though the parents are very questionable. It's kind of hard to navigate that, and then to be this rather poorly treated employee who is nonetheless assigned the task of caring for a very vulnerable, dependent child. It's hard stuff.
We also really tried to be very careful to create moments of sympathy for Mrs. X and for Mr. X. With Mrs. X, she never behaves badly except when motivated by being neglected by her husband. Every time she lashes out, we clearly tried to show sort of to connect the dots of where that behavior originated. And with Mr. X at the very end of the book, his mother shows up, and you realize no one ever hugged him either or gave him a bath or played with a rubber ducky. And he is just as much a victim as this entire system as anyone. I mean, again, you know, these are people not making good choices in dire circumstances. But I think we try to sort of humanize these people as much as possible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your characters often don't have names. There's Girl, there's Nanny, there's Mr. and Mrs. X. Why is that?
I think it's a great way for us to call a system into question, to say this is not one family or one woman in one office, but that these problems are universal.
It's actually a device that we find much more challenging creatively than just giving a character a name, because a character with a name, whatever that name is, does seem to engender or to call up for the reader certain personality, or, you know, names can be very evocative and distinctly bring something with the character into the room. And by calling a character Girl or Guy, we found the onus is 100% on us to flesh out all of the details to make that character as not stereotypical as possible.
But they're also in roles where they are kind of, you know, a stock figure to some degree. The nanny is just, you know, nanny, and is not in that job for her personality.
But she is perceived that way by the exes. Will always be nanny to the exes and to the ex community. And similarly, in Girl's journey, the minute Girl walks into the office and sits down at the board table and begins to talk, she's being viewed through the lens of her gender and her age by the people in that room, who are mostly older and mostly male. And that's a box she can't get out of. It's certainly that we've been nannies, we've been girls. In fact, on most of our media, we're called the nanny girls. So these novels have been a great way for us to play with what we feel like those boxes are.
Well, I've been talking or asking you questions mainly about Nanny, the Nanny Diaries, but let's talk a bit about Citizen Girl. You're writing about the world of work, which is a topic that is very under-investigated in our culture. But you also bring feminism into the scene, which is certainly not a very popular item in our culture either.
Are you kidding? It's all over the bestseller list.
Oh yeah. I must have
missed
it.
It's like The Notebook does feminism, The Da Vinci Code feminism.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a huge think bestseller, think feminism.
The novel opens with a rather monstrous but a hilarious old feminist character who is supposed to be speaking on behalf of young girls, but not very nice to the one she's got on the scene. So was there any real-life inspiration for this?
That character was, I think, born out of many women that Emma and I worked for directly out of college. I think coming out of the gate, it's very tempting to look for a mentor, for someone who's going to lay out a blueprint of how the next 10, 15 years of your life are going to progress. And it's a misplaced need, definitely. I mean, I think we've been reading a lot of successful corporate women talking about, you know, advice that they would give to younger women. All of them say, don't look for a mentor. Your boss is your boss. They're not there to guide you, take your hand and guide you through. But a lot of our friends ended up working, for, you know, coming out of gender studies programs in college, believing that their first female boss was going to be the one, the answer and the reason. And that incredible heartbreak of finding out that this person might have one set of ideology and not be able to practice what they preach at all. So that was something we really – and for us it was also very important to see who could that first boss be who would make the boss that is sort of the uber boss for the rest of the story seem like a relief. You know, who would be the setup where Guy, who Girl works for the rest of the book, is going to feel like a breath of fresh air for at least 50 pages? And that was Doris Weintruck.
There was also, though, I think, an issue of generational conflicts among feminists. Like, it seems like a lot of boomer and older feminists don't entirely trust the younger, their successor generation. So are you playing with that at all?
Yeah. I mean, feminism, the movement, has, to our eyes, faced just tremendous challenges. I think the strategies employed by popular culture to disable it have been extremely sophisticated. And I think we certainly don't blame Doris for her mistrust of Girl
or for her lousy managing. I think it's not at all uncommon. I don't think you'd hear this just from feminists, but I think from any revolutionary movement, that the leaders of those movements are not necessarily tremendously talented and effective managers. Generally, revolutionaries don't come with great leading management, you know, office management skill sets. And why should they? Nor should I say do most corporate leaders. Management and leadership do not go hand in hand, which is a constant heartbreak, I think, within working. It's a constant expectation that gets let down. We just people who are the best salesmen, who are the best with the clients, who are visionaries, just don't necessarily come with the skill set that makes someone a very strong manager, which is usually pretty extraordinary people skills and pretty extraordinary organizational skills. And so we're sympathetic to Doris in that Doris has about $1.50 to keep feminism alive in 2005, which is a pretty tall order in this day of Girls Gone Wild on primetime. And I think if Doris had adequate funding and adequate staffing, et cetera, I think she would be entirely a different manager to Girl than she in fact is, which is she's a nightmare.
Funny nightmare, though.
Everybody's a funny nightmare when it comes to us.
That's the voice of Ed McLaughlin, who is here with her collaborator, Nicola Krauss, the authors of Citizen Girl and, before that, The Nanny Diaries. Now, both these books, well, I alluded to this earlier, but both these books can be pigeonholed as what they call chick lit, you know. And I can't say I'm very well read in their genre, but I understand that it's not
Neither
taken seriously.
So,
but you know, my impression was that it was mostly about diets and keeping and dates. Failed diets and bad dates and drinking less and all those sorts of things. This is not what these books are about. But what about? I mean, this whole way of demeaning concern books by and about women,
it's
you seem to be fall into that to a degree.
We are women,
right.
And it is about women,
right?
So we are absolutely fall into that.
It's depressing to us that any time women have joined an artistic movement en masse, that there ends up being a subcategory that somehow women's fiction is lesser than men's fiction, which just gets to be fiction. And this bizarre title of chick lit, it's interesting. We were interviewed by a journalist who was doing a piece on chick lit. She got a list from the publishers of their chick lit authors, called the authors, and the authors were like, I don't write chick lit. I mean, we just think of ourselves as writing women, you know, books about women's issues, not necessarily for female readers. You know, we have lots of male readers, and we definitely keep our male readers in mind while we're writing.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Do you know the breakdown of is this?
With Nanny, I think it was pretty much 50-50.
Really?
With the girl, I have no idea. But the men who have read it and who've been in touch with us, you know, really responded to the book and absolutely related to it. You know, I think Helen Fielding is an amazing writer. She wrote Bridget Jones. And she definitely brought a new honesty to women's fiction that was quite revolutionary at the time. But I think then a lot of people then came barreling down in what they thought were her footsteps and narrowed down the focus of what's supposedly on women's minds down to shopping and dating. And, you know, that's just not where our friends seem to – we're focused on our careers, contributing, making it all work. And that seems to be so much more interesting to my – maybe shopping's fascinating and I'm missing out. I don't know.
We'd rather do the shopping than read about the shopping.
But also the world of work is not something that's really written about all that much, is it?
No, it's not.
And we can tell you for very understandable reasons, it is very challenging to make an office space, a floor of an office, a dramatic environment unless you do kill someone. It's quite understandable that John Grisham brings the level of CIA intrigue to a standard office floor. You know, you can only sit down at a desk, slump over a desk, lean back on a desk, put your feet up on a desk, but so many times for 300 pages and keep the pulse pulsing. I do say, I think to our credit, and it was an extremely hard work to try to stay in the realms of realism and create a plot line that had suspense but also stayed in the drama of work. And that actual inspiration came from the fact that in our realities, starting in our early 20s and only escalating, when we hang out with our friends and get a drink after work, or have brunch on the weekends. Or if you're just riding on a subway in Manhattan at rush hour and you hear two women talking passionately and with voices rising and sometimes tears coming to the eyes, it is the central drama of the boss, of the colleague, of being overwhelmed by one's tasks, of being underwhelmed of one's tasks, of questioning if this is the route one will be in for the rest of one's life, of being kept down, of being pushed up. This really has been the central drama, and we weren't seeing it reflected back to us.
We're running low on time, but you got anything else in the works?
We just finished our first screenplay this week, which we sent off on little wings to Los Angeles for our agent to take a look at. And we're just starting our next screenplay. And I think we'll get back to writing books in 2006.
Screenplay for?
Our last, it's just a romantic comedy. And now we're writing a thriller.
Not one of the novels being
About the rollicking life of two female novelists. No, it's nothing to do with novelists. But I think we're not seeing as many female-driven stories in Hollywood as we would like. So we're trying to do a little something about that.
That's right.
Well, I think you do a great, great job, and look forward to many more to come. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I've been speaking with Nicola Krause and Emma McLaughlin, authors of Citizen Girl most recently. When did this come out?
November.
So it's will it be coming out in paper anytime soon?
September.
So
it's a long way. Don't
yeah,
wait.
Yeah, long way.
Get
so
right
everyone
out
should
there.
Run out and buy a copy of the hardcover, and then also Nanny Diaries from several years ago, which is out in paper and
yes.
Available everywhere. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be. I think I'm off next week because of some important event or other. So I'll be back in 2 weeks, and stay tuned for the news. And let's go out with a bit more of Sonic Youth.
Sunshine, the lights will blind us with blues and haiku.